Paul Podcast Network.
Welcome to Arts on Air, a podcast featuring an eclectic mix of writers, artists, musicians, and other creative thinkers whose work explores dimensions of culture, spirit, community, and commitment. I'm Debbie Holton. Join me as I engage each about their own creative journey, their inspirations, and the one thing they feel is most important that we must know. Welcome. Episode 3 features Allison Adele Hedge Koch. At the AWP Writers Conference this past spring, I caught up with Allison, where we had a chance to talk about her life and work. She descends from mound builders and is of Cherokee, Huron, Creek, French-Canadian, Lorraine, Portuguese, English, Scot, and Irish ascendants. Raised in North Carolina, the Plains, and Canada, she previously worked horses, fields, waters, and factories. She's a founding fellow at the Black Earth Institute think tank and is a fellow with the McDonald Colony. She's a professor at the Institute of American Indian Arts and a member of the summer faculty at Naropa University. Her Dog Road Woman collection of poetry, published by Coffee House Press, received the American Book Award. Off-Season City Pipe is another collection of poetry, also published by Coffee House Press, and Rock, Ghost, Willow, Deer is a memoir published by UNE. Her most recent collection, Blood Run, is a free verse play, and you'll hear her talk about it in our interview. Allison Hedge Koch. What brought you to this writing life, your artist life, your activist life?
I think it was sort of never a time or a place where I actually made conscious decisions. It was more innate preference. This is the way we approach life. This is the way we do this for the time of childhood. We were raised to be very active and be participants. And if there was something wrong, it was up to us to fix it. And we had that early schooling from my father. And he also taught us to be resourceful and to work with what we had and to make a habit of giving back every time something came your way. And if you had a way to leverage, share it with other people, you get a door open, bring everybody through. And with the writing, my sister and I were very intent or purposeful about that. As small children, we learned the alphabet not to learn the letters. We learned the alphabet to manipulate language. And it was intentional. We were purposeful about it. And it offered us a place where we could engage with one another no matter what was happening in the family or what was happening in our lives at that time. And my mother's schizophrenic, and she was totally chronically insane by the time I was 15 months old. And when she was in the home, it was full-blown screaming 24 hours a day. And when she was out of the home, she was in asylum. And her screaming was directed at the walls and evil doers who we couldn't see. But it was also directed at us because she believed us to be programmed by her own personal delusions. So we were part of the delusion as well. And in order to cope with that and in order to transcend what was going on in the home and love our mother, as our father conditioned us to do, we learned a variety of coping mechanisms and tools, most of which were based in focusing on other people's needs and making sure other people were being attended to, and or doing something creative or purposeful between us. And it alleviated a lot of the stress in the family. We stayed together as a family. My father never left my mother. And my sister and I both became writer-activists. So it's the conditioning. And I attribute that to my ancestry more than anything else.
Could you talk a little bit about the steps that brought you to deciding you were going to be a writer as your output, your literary output?
reflex. I mean, for example, talk a little bit about Blood Run and how you got to that what that is. I'm sure our listeners would love to know.
Thank you. It's the new release is a verse play. It's a volume of poetry that reads from end to end as a work. And it deals with an indigenous mountainside in eastern South Dakota that in the 1700s was still populated by 10,000 indigenous people, six different nations, when the French came through. So it was a huge city. It was a trade city. Most of the cities that were here in North America have not been acknowledged, spoken about, addressed in any way, shape, or form that gives dignity to the civilizations that pre-existed before anyone came from Europe and interrupted what was happening in North America, South America, Central America. And I was living in eastern South Dakota. I had been raised around our own mountain sites in the southeast. My family's intertribal. On my southern side, we're Cherokee. We have some Creek as well. And on my northern side, we're Huron. We have some Métis. I'm also French, Canadian, and Portuguese. And we were raised around our the mound knowledge as children. My father's a storyteller, and he is pretty much a collective thinker. And he was born in 1922, my mother in 1921. My grandparents on my father's side were born in 1878 and 1882. So there's gaps in the family between generations that allowed us to maintain a lot of our traditional knowledges and historical elements. So we were pretty versed in Mound culture and that history within our own tribal parameters. And living in eastern South Dakota next to this phenomenal mound site and seeing how little attention was paid to it and how much desecration was going on, I began to lobby for this site and work with the state of South Dakota for many, many years lobbying to do something to protect the site and buy it back from the farmers that are plowing it under. And was successful in January of 2003 in convincing the commission that was put up to do the hearings for that site after years of lobbying for it to convince them to preserve and protect the land. There's no money yet to buy the land back so that it can be protected or preserved. And while I was working out there, I came into different voices within the poetry that were persona related. And I got the idea, well, I'll do the verse play, pay some tribute to the site, allow the site to speak for itself, in essence. And, you know, you're always the vessel as a writer anyway, so just allow that condition to happen or that presence to be there. And began to create the verse play. I was lucky to be supported by a couple of grants during that time to get that work done. And it's been released in the UK and it's been released in the US now, and it's out there. But it's a conversation, and the mound site has various personalities which speak through poetry. Some of which are landscape elements of persona, some of which are character elements. Some are very good characters that have great integrity, and some are totally desecrating the land and have no conscience about what's happening. And that's more the manifest destiny type characterization of what was happening in that parameter of early occupation by Europeans and the removal of the people who were living in the area, etc. So it has some real beautiful elements and has some pretty horrendous elements as well. It's my fifth book that I've authored, and I've also edited six other books. And it's the first time I've worked in this form. I've written a full-length three-act play, and I've done other volumes of poetry, but it's the first time I coupled the two, so that's a new venture for me. But it seemed very natural. Mm-hmm. It's not about me, it's about this place and the people who were there and the presence that's still there today and the ones that are still buried there as well. But coming into the writing, I mean, I always knew I was going to write, and we just thought, you know, you do things, you do them well, and you go out and continue doing it. Whether it was working on a car and changing brakes or doing a painting, it was just something people do, and you go out in the world with it. So I always knew I would be writing at some point in time. I always knew I would publish books at some point in time. And it wasn't a matter of an ego. It wasn't a matter of a decision. It's just I knew I was full of these things, and they would go out. I would put them out into the world. And there would be a place for that at some point in time. But it took me a while to find that place. It took me a while to find a comfort zone in publishing. And I didn't attempt to publish for quite a long time. And I've been pretty judicious about what I send out, and I certainly don't publish everything I write. A lot of it's just for the process, you know. But sort of threefold venue, I guess, for me, or entrance into the venue, you know, the early conditioning, the work that needs to be spoken to that's out there, and being full of the flow. It's just there. I get emotion and I got all kinds of ideas and it just don't stop. It's like the storm going on in the head, you know.
You're listening to Arts on Air on the DePaul Podcast Network.
I'm imagining a huge well that you dip from, a you know, the gourd in hand.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that you're,
you bet.
You're, what kinds of things come up for you that I mean, you've mentioned the tribal mounds and the wanting to speak for the land that has no voice.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other... Are there people that speak to you too? Who are your inspirations? What other inspirations come to you that must be spoken about?
Well, I think I'm inspired by everything in life. I really do. I've never had a bored moment. I don't even understand boredom, really. I think the boredom equates to apathy. And I just don't have those feelings. I'm concerned about everything. I can be inspired by a fly on the wall. You know, it's just there's things to consider in life, and I think it really comes out of that point of consideration where you're carrying consideration with you that allows you to have time to muse or dwell, and everything flows from there. We're a narrativizing culture, so we want everyone to come into our perspective and share that perspective, get the conversation going. So we have that, mm-hmm. And I think it's always adding in or punctuating the conversation. I'm inspired by the natural world, I'm inspired by the urban world, I'm inspired by peoples all over the world, animals, you name it. But I'm also inspired just by the presence of moment or stillness and sound and everything. Everything's inspiring to me. People-wise, I'm inspired by the cab driver. I'm inspired by the woman that was pouring coffee this morning, remembering when I was pouring coffee for people. You know, I'm inspired by everybody that's around. People are inspiring in many ways, especially if you're noticing or in the process of noticing the fragility of human condition and what's happening with people and what people are really carrying with them and tapping into that. And trying to find a place for that to illuminate and looking at it as material or fodder so that it can illuminate rather than oppress or suppress or hinder. And I think I'm very interested in looking for ways to transcend, and a lot of the work is really about that. And not just for myself, but for whoever needs the rise, whoever needs the shine to occur, you know, is putting it out there so that it can be there for that person. Interestingly enough, I got an email from a person I really don't even know, but she's on a list that I'm on. I don't think we've ever corresponded directly. And I was instructed to get a contract to her for another publication. And when I emailed her back, she said, "By the way, I'm reading Blood Run now, and it's helping me through a very difficult time. Thank you for writing it." And that's really what it's about. You know, it's having the text in the hands of whoever needs it at the time that they need it. And that's way beyond you. You're just throwing it out there and hoping that it lands where it needs to be. And I think that it does. I think it essentially does. Hopefully, it gets where it needs to be when it needs to be there. It's like the old adage. They always say you have to have a well to give well, right? They always say that. And whoever shows up are the people that need to be there. Right? Mm-hmm. And I think both of those are very true reflections of that condition with the work as well.
You touch so many things. Your words touch people. You touch people and you change them through your engagement with them, your consistent engagement. If there's one thing you want us as an audience to know, what would that one thing be?
Everything in life is temporary, and we got to savor it while we have the flavor of it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we miss it all together, and it's gone.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. Great. And I'm going to sip my tea.
Thank you.
Tell us, where can we find more about you? Are there sites on the web that we can go to that where we can discover more about you?
Yeah, there's quite a few. The only one that I've ever put up is just a name check blog, really. I have it's hedgecoke.net, and all one word, lowercase. And there's some pictures of my books and stuff, and underneath there are a series of web links of other people, places, situations, engagements that I think need to be attended to. And so that's mine. But the rest that are up are through various presses, and I teach at the Institute of American Indian Arts and at Naropa in the summer. So there's tons of web pages out there, so just Googling Allison Hedgecoke, Hedgecoke two words will get you more than you want to know.
I doubt we will still be hungry for the flavor.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Deborah.
This is wonderful.
Beautiful.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Arts on Air. The theme music you hear, Cherimoya Groove, was produced by Debbie Woodholton and Arnold Graham. A detail from the painting Girl in Clouds by Chevette Williams is the artwork you see. A special shout-out thank you goes to Dr. Robert Rottenberg in the Anthropology Department at DePaul University. If you'd like to contact me, I'd love to hear from you. Send me an email at artsonair@gmail.com. I'm Debbie Holton. I hope you'll join us next time on Arts on Air.